Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Welcome to the Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about subclassing, the possibility of adding more classes to your D&D game, and how many and when and whether there can possibly be too many or not.
It's actually an interesting historical question that you may or may not know the answer to. Like, is AD&D the only version that actually designated specific classes as subclasses?
I think that terminology started in original D&D.
Really? Okay.
So, it is true that AD&D is, to a large extent, just compiling what's in the original D&D supplements. So, original D&D came out in 74, and I think within 8 months, they had the first supplement, Greyhawk, that added thieves and paladins, and paladins are being referred to as a subclass of fighters.
Interesting.
So I think eight months after the little brown books came out.
I think starting around third is where we stop seeing them called subclasses and they're just classes.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think they still called them subclasses in second edition, I think.
Yeah. So I think second was, fairly similar to first in that regard.
Yeah, I think so too. So when I was looking at this in the last day or two, it's kind of interesting how quickly that happened. I would have thought that adding these classes historically took a longer time, but that's not the case. The 1, 2, 3 supplements for original D&D, and just a couple issues, the first couple issues of the Strategic Review magazine that turned into Dragon. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you've added everything that you see in AD&D. You've got thieves and paladins and rangers and illusionists and monks and bards and druids. And that's everything you see in the AD&D Player's Handbook. So it happened surprisingly quickly.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then, the Dragon magazine starts, I think, 78, 77, something like that. And again, they're presenting all kinds of new classes pretty quickly. The third issue of Dragon had nine different classes, and none of those ever got into the core rules ever again. That's before the AD&D books, and it seems like nothing, even though they were pumping out new classes all the time, it really never got into the core of it. So the nine or whatever you see in AD&D were there really surprisingly fast.
I feel like when you're adding classes or adding races or possibly even adding spells, in all those cases, you're really targeting the player more than the DM. And I feel like there's been this constant progression in D&D of trying to give the players more stuff. More, not stuff like inventory, but more things to engage with. More ways, more details for their character.
I think that we're very conscious of that now. And I'm wondering how deliberate that point that you just made was to begin with.
That's a good point. Yeah, they may not have even thought it that in that direction. I feel like by second edition splat books, that's where it feels to me like, oh, they've figured out that this is the way to market their product and to produce more product.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, how much are the supplements hung on those ideas versus how much are they like footnotes? And if I look at supplement one or supplement two, what's the page count devoted to, say, the new classes versus other stuff?
It's hard. Okay, the page count is, I don't know, like 4 pages. Okay, so you get 2 pages for the thief and you get about 2 pages of the paladin, roughly speaking. They're the first thing in the book. right? Yep. I mean, the way those things are structured is, you know, classes and then spells and then monsters and then items all the time.
Right, so, but they're like following the precedent, right, of the original books, I think, right? Just organizationally.
You're right. Yep, totally correct. And so, you know, and then there's also the possibility of some people say, well, you know, the thief is so incredibly weak, it wasn't even intended as a player class. These are supposed to be, you're supposed to be hireling thieves that are fragile and have sucky abilities and have D4 hit points originally. And no player in their right mind would actually take a thief.
Right.
So I'm wondering, like, to what extent they accept. Now, obviously, anyone says thief, tricky, sneak around, skulk in the shadows and backstab, and half of our players all clearly have an appetite for that.
Yep.
But I'm wondering how much they stumbled into that, because it doesn't, there's that, you know, the paladin is just whether you rolled a 17 for charisma or not on your fighter.
Yeah. It's funny, I was just talking to another friend about paladins, and, you know, when players, I was just trying to think, random thought process just went through my head, is like, why did thieves stick and paladins didn't, if they were both, like, the first new things introduced? But paladins have always had, I think, been much more niche, right? They have, like, sort of a moral implication as well as a stat requirement. They're just, I guess, a little, I don't know. My memory of paladins when I was a kid was that I'm more used to, like, first edition AD&D paladins, where it was more than just charisma, right? You had to have a certain wisdom and a certain strength, maybe. I had a lot of requirements, I think.
Definitely strength and charisma.
Yeah, I thought there was at least three. I remember it being a big deal that if you rolled the stats and you went, oh my gosh, I qualify for paladin, like, you had better be a paladin.
Totally. You're right. Oh shit, yeah. They need everything, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was really rough.
Sorry, that's rain. I'm looking at ranger. No, they need everything. No, there's a minimum. Yeah, there's a minimum everything.
Yeah.
Except dexterity. You can have crappy dexterity. Everything else, there's a minimum for.
You can be a clumsy paladin, but otherwise you better be awesome.
Yeah, totally.
It's funny.
Wow.
Huh. Okay, sorry. Random tangent.
It's just charisma.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing I'll point out is in supplement one, you have a section on classes, and there's the thief, and then, you know, in standard horrible organization fashion, the paladin isn't there. The paladin is actually a footnote over in the abilities section. So later on they have, oh, here's new stuff you can do with strength and intelligent for spells. And charisma, and oh, by the way, if your charisma is really high, you can be a paladin that does this and this and this.
Sure.
So paladins are actually just a footnote on the charisma table.
That's weird. Well, I mean, interestingly, right, paladins will, from that point forward, always be classified as a subclass, whereas thieves are not a subclass, right? Thieves are a
right.
top-level thing.
Exactly. I mean, maybe that's a large part of it, is paladins are just a particularly costumed fighter, but thieves clearly don't fit into anything else.
Fascinating.
Maybe that's a large part of it, yeah.
So yeah. So what are you using, Dan? I know you use a lot of supplement one, but not all of it.
Yeah, my classic almost unique take is to use thieves to replace clerics.
Yep.
And that's it.
No paladins.
So I have, you know, so I do run with just three classes on the table for players, and it's fighter, magic user, and thief, and that's it.
Yep.
What do you do these days?
I do the same. It took me longer to get there, and I didn't really do that until, until really fully adopting your OED as written stuff on your website.
Because you have excellent taste.
So, you know, for a long time I was running BX, and of course BX, right. Actually, let me go back. For a long time I was running Labyrinth Lord, really. I was running BX / Labyrinth Lord.
Yeah.
Labyrinth Lord, like BX, has the races class. So there's, you know, so there, yeah. There are no races. There's just seven classes. One of them is dwarf, one is elf, one is halfling. And I that still has a special place for me. I still like that. I think there is a certain style of game you end up playing when that happens. When elves are, I don't know, it feels very Tolkien to me.
Okay.
That elves are a different thing from wizards, and they both have magic, but they're their own unique thing.
Okay.
Right? You don't have elven wizards, you just have elves and wizards, right? I feel like the way Tolkien described it, wizards were almost not really human either. They're wizards.
Right. And there's only five of them or something like that? Yeah. World or something?
I don't know. I'm not a huge Tolkien scholar. But anyway, I always liked that. As I played with my group, they wanted more of those interesting, unusual classes. And so I started pulling in stuff from Brave Halfling. So Brave Halfling was publishing some supplements for Labyrinth Lord at the time of, here's how to add a Ranger class, and here's how to add a Paladin class. And I liked it because it kind of BX-ified things like the Ranger, so rather than having weird, unique stuff and spell casting and blah, blah, blah. I think actually it gave you a couple options. It was like, oh, you can have a Ranger that's more like a thief where he's got these skills, or you could have a Ranger that's a spellcaster or whatever. So I think I pulled in Ranger and Paladin from Brave Halfling. So then I was at, like, what is that, 9 classes? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then eventually was convinced to house rule in a race class split. So I did that. And then from there, I started getting more and more OED-ish. What I realized was when I went to conventions, I was removing all the paladins and rangers from my pregens.
Yep.
I was like, too finicky, too weird. I don't know. I don't want them for this particular adventure or whatever. Yep. And then eventually I was like, you know what? I'm just not using them. So let's get rid of them.
Interesting. So, God, so many things. So I got two footnotes. So item number one, apparently I ran into the following in the past, and then I rediscovered it a couple days ago. So a gentleman who goes by Xenopus Archives online, who just does wonderful work on studying BX, read these initial drafts of Lord of the Rings, and to my personal amazement, the character of Strider the Ranger, where the whole Ranger things comes out in the early drafts, was a hobbit.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so if you look at it, it's kind of interesting how the abilities that we in D&D we connote with halflings or hobbits really kind of follow suit from rangers, actually. The hiding in woods and stuff like this and being good with ranged weapons and all that kind of stuff. It actually kind of trickles down from the original write-up of the ranger character. So there are some people that point to the whole halfling race in BX as being the analog of a BX ranger.
That's interesting. I guess I could see that.
Yeah. And then some people have this hot take on it, which I kind of like. It's sort of too bad they turned him into a human, because it sort of has a bit of a white human savior disease for the hobbits. Like, originally there was like a totally badass hobbit who was in charge of like saving the whole race.
Yep.
And then it got turned into a human instead. So that's kind of an interesting hot take on
that. It really would have put a weird twist on the whole love affair with an elf if it had been a hobbit.
Yeah. I don't know if that was there or not, but yeah, I mean, like, dude, that guy's balling.
Interesting.
And the other thing is, while I was reading some early Dragon magazines this week, it's kind of interesting because you're talking about maybe the races class that to me was new in Moldvay BX, which systematically I'm kind of aggravated about. In Dragon magazine number 3, they have this giant friggin' list of new classes, and one of them is a dedicated dwarf fighter class. So one of them is specific, like if you're a dwarf and you're a fighter, use this different table, and it's got a whole bunch of different abilities, different XP sequencing.
So what is the implication of what a regular dwarf is then? I mean, I always thought dwarves were pretty close to fighter.
So this is pre-BX, right? This is pre-BX. And in original D&D, they're separate. You're a dwarf and you've got to be a fighter, basically.
Yep.
And so this guy's coming in and saying, if you're a dwarf and a fighter, you ought to have this unique profile to that. So I don't know if that feels...
Is he just customizing the dwarf, or is he proposing a second variant of dwarf?
Well, okay, it's delivered as a variant of fighter. So it's a new class of fighter that only dwarves can be. So to my perspective, the language he's using is, this is a subclass of fighter that dwarves must be and can only be this now.
Right. So it's a replacement. It's not like you're going to have classic dwarves and new dwarves together in the same game.
I think that's the intention.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That makes more sense to me. They're just trying to customize the dwarf a little, make him a little more unique. Yep. I get it.
Exactly. So I don't know if that's where the germ of that idea of racist class came from, but there's that one, to me, that looks very odd, of this, like, dwarf fighter class.
You know, admittedly, when I first sat down to reread the three LBBs, I would say it's pretty confusing if race and class are different or not. Right? Because it says, like, you can be a dwarf, but all dwarves are X, and you can be an elf, and all elves are X. Right, like if you ignore all the house ruling we've done around multiclassing and elves, like I'm pretty sure by the LBBs, elves are just some weird fighter magic user. Is it true?
Yeah,
they have both, right? Yeah,
right. You know, okay. So if you look, you're 99.999% correct. Mm-hmm. If you look, and I have this underlined in my book, I just happen to have it open to this page. Actually, you're talking about right this second. And technically, the word that's sitting there is the word or. Mm. So it actually says elves are fighters. So elves start as fighters or magic users and can switch from adventure to adventure, is what it says.
Right. And, but there's still almost kind of this weird, unique thing, right?
Yeah.
They're both classes. They're both, but only one at a time. It's weird and awkward. I mean, I grant you, it's the reason we've house ruled the crap out of it, right? Because it's just like the text is a little incomprehensible as to what they're getting at.
I feel like this is one of these places where you point at original D&D and you say you cannot play with this, right? It is so bizarre and confusing that everybody's got to make some kind of interpretation there.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's one of those places whereby every game's going to be different. Because of passages like this, because what it says is just almost inconceivable.
And now I often forget to think about it. But what does Holmes have to say about race and class?
Yeah, a lot of the time he copy pastes what's out of original D&D.
Yeah, yeah.
So he says the same things. He does not have combined race and class like Moldvay does. And then he also, you know, since he's looking at the supplements, he also says, because he has thieves, and he says, now advanced D&D allows your dwarves and elves to possibly be thieves if you want that, but you have to look at AD&D for that.
Oh, that's interesting. But he's already talking about AD&D, which has already done the split. It's just weird because reading BX straight, I always got the impression of, like, if Moldvay and Cook were simply operating from the original LBBs and were totally unaware of AD&D, which we all know can't possibly be the case,
yeah.
But I could see how they could arrive at race as class from that's what I think the book says. That's what I think LBBs say.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, but of course, they came years after AD&D is published, so they must know. So they must have made an intentional choice there of, well, even though AD&D went this way, we're going to go this other direction for some reason.
I agree with that. I mean, I bet if we could go back in time and talk to Moldvay, he's like, I'm trying to simplify this whole thing.
Yeah,
you know,
it's basic, right?
He's the first one to came up, I'm going to have consistent ability numbers for every single score.
Yep.
Right? That's the first time we had that. I bet Moldvay's saying, I don't want people to deal with separate silos of experiences. Everybody has one single experience score. You look at one table. This tells you what you get.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, that makes sense.
I kind of like the nuance of my characters having multiple silos of experience and deciding which one to improve in myself, but I can see someone making a simpler basic game not wanting that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It definitely, I always got the impression that, and I feel like we're off on a super tangent here, but I always got the impression that, like, part of the goal of Basic was not only to, you know, simplify and clarify, but to also target a younger audience. And unfortunately, then just looking at it as a raw source, it's not always clear what was made in the name of targeting a younger audience versus what was made specifically just because it's confusing for anyone, right? Like, you could see somebody saying, well, AD&D is confusing for kids, so let's make a basic game for kids. But sometimes it's confusing for everyone. And sometimes you're clarifying not just for the kids.
That's a good point. It's not something I would actually think of a lot of the time, but that's a fair point. I don't normally look at BX and think this is partly made for kids. It looks like...
It says 10 and up right on the box.
Really?
Yep. Age is 10 and up. Right on the box.
Well, you win that one. You win that one.
Anyway, subclasses. Let's talk.
Here's a third point.
Yeah.
In Dragon Magazine number 3, I don't know how much I even want to talk about this. Dragon Magazine that has this giant plethora of classes. One of the articles is this completely infamous article by Len Lakofka. That has, oh, here's a version of all the basic classes, fighter, magic user, cleric, and thief, if you want to be a woman. Yeah, if you want to be a woman, we've got to have custom classes for that, right? So here's customized woman fighter and woman magic user and woman thief. And, you know, women fighters... Their strength is terrible because we all, you know, their strength tops out at 14. You can't have a strength more than 14. And you fight at one level lower.
It's so painful.
Than normal fighters. But wow, women are great at thieves because they are tricky and they will steal your money. So they have all kinds of extra seduction.
Stop, anyway, please stop.
Yeah,
please, please, you're killing me. Oh, yeah, Len.
It's awful. Yeah, it's terrible.
Should have stopped at L1. L1 is a great module. I love that module.
Yeah, Len. Yeah, I mean, there's some really sad, embarrassing, shameful crap back there. And man, I'm glad that died. And obviously, no one's heard of that in a long time.
Okay, yeah, so
it's awful.
Let's avoid that incredible landmine. Let's wander around that for a minute. Okay, great. So. Yeah. Subclasses. Here's the problem with subclasses. Whether they're subclasses or not, just more classes, right? Really, the problem is more classes, and which is something that I've played with and then moved away from. Why did I do that? It's the same problem I see now in 5th edition. 5th edition is chock full of race and class choices. Too many. And players are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of choice. And... Okay. They claim to like it. They claim to really love it, right? It's like the most popular thing is, this new expansion, this new book has new races, new classes. Woohoo, I love it because, I don't know, I've been playing D&D for so long that I've gotten bored of the same old, so I want something new. the downside, though, is that new players coming into the game are now facing a list of a dozen classes or a dozen races, and they're like, oh, there's so much. And then possibly they then self-select into the most extreme. Either I'm going to be human, I'm going to be the most boring, plain, vanilla character, or I'm going to be a turtle person.
I think I see this. I think I agree with this, and I think I see the same trend. So I think that's a good point.
I think that's where we end up, unfortunately. And it's really tough as DM. I know, I've posted about this on my blog, about my dislike for the weirdo races, as I call them. But the problem really for me is, you and I both have played with our friend BJ, who makes a ton of weirdo races, but he always does it as part of world building, right? He's like, I'm going to have this new world. It's going to be Arabian themed, so we're going to have, turtle people because they live in the desert, and that's a turtle. That's a race.
Right. So I wouldn't say he makes a ton. Like, when I come to the table, mostly at convention-type things, I mean, he's got 3 or 4, right?
Yeah. He's also cleverly doing it as replacements, right?
Yeah,
he's saying,
exactly.
Rather than the normal XYZ, you get this, right?
Right.
And so that works reasonably well, I think. The problem comes when you just have this smorgasbord of options which are not tied to any fiction or any pre-thought out anything. And now we just have this crazy amalgam of everything.
Yeah.
And that is what I rebel against. That's what I don't like. You know, sort of like saying, it reminds me of Renaissance fairs. I used to go to Renaissance fairs as a teenager. Okay. And I was super into history. And so I liked the idea of, we're emulating this period of time from way back when. Which period of time? Is it medieval? Is it Renaissance? No, it's Renaissance. It's called the Renaissance fairs. The Renaissance period. But then all this other crap starts leaking in. And also we have elf ears. And also we have, like every element of every fantasy anything anywhere is now part of a Ren fair. If you go to a Ren fair, it's like its own category of thing now. Really? Because it's just...
Really?
I don't know. It's everything. Shove it in there.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How does that... don't they have, this whole, family hierarchy system that's run nationally? Was that a thing? I thought there was I'm a duke that's part of this earldom that's part of the nation of the Northeast New England something.
Are you thinking maybe of SCA, the Society of Creative Anachronisms?
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm mixing that up.
Because they do that. And for sure, they're trying to emulate a specific period of history, and that's much more targeted. Whereas if you go to the New York Ren Fair, where is that up in, I can't remember the name of the town. Anyway, it's the one I used to go to. It's just freaking everything, man. If it at all smacks of the fantasy genre in any way, it's in there.
I did not know that.
Yep.
That's interesting. So clearly, there's a commercial concern and, at least now that the companies have become laser conscious of the desire that players have for expanded options and maybe power inflated options, possibly, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. We're on this additional cycle of here's the core rules, back to basics, you get the 4, 5, or 9 classes, and then we're going to build and build and build, and now it's overwhelming, and now we need a new addition to bring you back down to something reasonable. In the early history of D&D, they had new classes, but they weren't getting into the core for almost 20 years, right? So once you had the 9, as of about 77, that was the same 9 that you saw all through first edition, all through second edition. Now it seems like they're coming out, now that someone's uttered the, we can sell more stuff to players with new classes, it seems like it comes much more rapidly at us.
I think that's true. I think that part of it is that they are trying to, I think 5th edition, here I'm going to toss out a crazy theory for you. I think that 5th edition is trying to bring everyone back to the table. That they felt that 4th edition was very divisive, right? Some people love 4th edition, but a lot of people rebelled against it and then went and found Pathfinder or whatever, something else. And so they were like, let's get everyone back to the table. So 5th edition feels a lot more like classic D&D, but also tieflings are there. And tieflings are a 4th editionism, right? So they're trying to entice... Let's make sure your favorite thing is in there. Let's make sure... That's at least there, so it feels familiar to everyone who loved the game.
Right.
I can't really fault them for that. I mean, that seems like a pretty reasonable approach.
They're much smarter. It seems like Wizards is much smarter about their business than I'm accustomed to the D&D manufacturers being, honestly. That's a very strong argument.
Certainly the corporate concern of modern day Wizards of the Coast is, of course, a radically different corporate entity than TSR of the early 80s.
Right.
Totally different people, totally different ideas.
Right.
Totally different place.
Right.
There's one thing, I'm trying to see if I can find this in D&D Beyond here because I don't actually have the physical book in front of me. But one interesting thing in 5th edition is it starts in the race section, starts with your classic races, human, dwarf, elf, halfling. They do shove some interesting tweaks in there. Here's your half elf, here's your drow, whatever. Here we go. Then it gets to uncommon races. And it quickly tells you, quote, I'm going to just read it to you. The Dragonborn and the rest of the races in this chapter are uncommon. They don't exist in every world of D&D, and even where they are found, they are less widespread than dwarves, elves, halflings, and humans.
Yeah.
Right, so they go out of their way in the text of the book to tell you, like, here's the extra weird stuff.
Right.
You're not necessarily going to see this in every game. This should be right. considered unusual. And the problem is D&D Beyond. D&D Beyond, great software, super helpful. I use it all the time. I love it. But in sort of quickly directing you to just the information you're looking for and cutting out the chaff, it also, you lose some of this contextual information. So if I go into D&D Beyond and I create a new character, it's not really super in my face of, like, you're choosing a race that's weird. Right? So
gotcha.
Like, here are the races.
Gotcha. Yep.
And that's, like, that initial character creation is the one place where they're at least good about, like, in the very beginning, they ask you a couple questions, and one of them is, what sources do you want to use? Do you want to use, like, just the player's handbook, or do you want to use, you know, all these extra books that maybe you don't even really own, your dungeon master owns and shared with you?
Yeah.
As you go down the road, once you've made your character, advancing your character, it's totally unclear. I've easily had cases where I've, like, brought in a spell, not realizing it was not in the player's handbook, because it just is there in the list of spells I don't know, so that's the one I chose.
Right, right.
I would say, though, and even... Sorry.
Go ahead.
I would say, even in the initial character creation, though, like, the choice is, no, limit me down to just the player's handbook, but still it's going to give equal weight to Dragonborn and Dwarf.
Well, that's what I was going to say right there, yeah. Even if you restrict it, even if you restricted the maximum PHB only, you still get that stuff you just listed.
I think as a DM, if you want to be like, I'm going to go super classic here and just have the four races and just the classic classes, you would have to really go out of your way if your players are using D&D Beyond to say, you can't be X.
Yeah.
Nope, I reject your character. He can't. That's not good. I told you, only humans, dwarves, elves, halflings.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it seems, so this sort of dovetails into... I saw someone making this point, is like the extra races and classes are attractive for players, and particularly if they're experts, and give them more options and possibly more power. But it actually gives a distinct disadvantage to the DM. Like, that's a lot of stuff for the DM to be familiar with.
Yep.
And that's a lot of stuff for the DM to juggle and know about. If the DM is trying to craft a careful and nuanced campaign world, we're running into the tools, you know, the tools in D&D Beyond don't really support that.
Yep.
So if the DM says, I don't have tieflings in this world, that's not a particular thing that's supported, or any spells or items or anything else that the DM wants to pick and choose from.
I mean, you're right. It is really difficult to do that. You have to have a very clear vision and know all the stuff up front. You either have to be an expert and know all the information, or what I see much more commonly, what I've even said myself in 5th edition games, is there's no way I can know all the abilities of all the races and classes.
Exactly.
You had better know how to run your character, because I don't.
Exactly. Exactly. And like, as a really old school DM, I guess it kind of likes to keep a firm grip on my campaign world. That makes me very uncomfortable. I really would not want someone coming with a character with abilities that I'm just trusting they know about, because I don't. That would make me very, very uncomfortable about whether the world's running in the direction I want or not.
Yep.
You know? Yep. So here's a thing that I'm perpetually, like, mechanically perpetually puzzled about, right? There's a lot of stuff in D&D that's modular. And you can add spells really easily, right? So here's some new spells, here's a new spell. My players on Friday night were wrestling with their first opportunity to research custom spells. So I actually had a proposed brand new spell I'd never heard of at the table on Friday night. And you know, a new spell, it could be 3 lines long, right? It's one ability.
Yep.
A new monster in original D&D can be 3 lines, you know, some statistics and maybe 3 or 4 lines of text.
Yep.
Magic items are the same extent. But the classes have to be like at least a page or two, right?
Yeah.
They're a whole different order of magnitude of extent of text and rules burden. And so so like when 3rd edition came out and said, now we have this feat system, my perspective was like, this is what should have always been the case for fighters. If you want to customize fighters, instead of a whole new class like Ranger or Paladin or Monk or whatever, mm-hmm. I like this. Here's a three line. You can take tracking. You can take two weapon fighting. You can use a holy sword, maybe something like that, right?
Yep.
And I was like, isn't this what the modular edition should have been all along, like a spell or a magic item? Is a little tiny plug-in piece and not a giant friggin' massive text for a class. And so for me, I feel like it should have been little tiny modular things to add to fighters or maybe other classes. But that doesn't seem to be sticky. It seems like the original players don't like feats. It doesn't seem like that's really core to 5th edition. It doesn't stop the class proliferation. I'm like, why wasn't it modular like the other stuff, like spells and items?
So, certainly, 5th edition does have, every four levels, you get a weird thing, which is totally written as an optional rule in 5th edition. Like, normally it's just you get an ability increase. But then optionally, maybe you want to use this list of special powers to really customize the crap out of your character.
Right. So not a core part of the system.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I seem to recall someone posting a blog post about how, point by systems where there's just a giant pool of abilities and you can combine them in whatever way you want, like, is basically always going to be broken.
Have a pool of points that you're buying a bunch of stuff.
Okay. If I'm creating a 12th level fighter, don't I have 3 points to spend on 3 abilities?
Think about that. That's it.
For our readers who aren't aware, that the blog author was, of course, Dan. I could see it. Certainly, like, the thing that I like is finding ways to express the kind of character you want to within the existing subset of rules. So, like, I remember when I first ran the A series modules at a convention, I was still running BX, so I was running them under BX, and those modules were written for first edition AD&D and had pre-gen characters, which don't fit in BX. There's, there's a fighter cleric. There's an illusionist.
Half elf, yeah.
Yep, and I'm like, what do I do about this? And when I was translating them, and I was trying to build their characters in BX, I discovered I was able to make Fanstern the illusionist really well by simply naming him Fanstern the illusionist, and then carefully picking the spells that go in his spellbook.
Right.
And giving him items that, like, yep, he's got a lot of illusion stuff. Okay, he's an illusionist. Great.
And in parallel, I did the exact same thing, right? I've been running A modules the last 2 years at our convention, and I did the precise exact same thing.
I mean, likewise, I think with your feat system, right, you could, if you play a fighter who has the berserking ability and plays as if they come from a less technologically advanced civilization, surely they're playing a barbarian, right?
Right. That's the intent. That's totally the intent. It seems like the easy way to do that. Plus, there's a feat to get extra hit points if you think barbarians should have extra hit points.
Nice.
I give them out, I give them out rarely, right? So I only give one out every fourth level. So there's some, there's some whetting of the appetite of, like, this is great. I love this feat, and I have to, go another four levels before I see another one.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly pretty different, I think, from, like, first edition AD&D, where you're looking at a wide range of, like, oh, if I start as a ranger, I get X, Y. I guess, actually, maybe not. Is a first-level ranger and a first-level fighter that different? Is the ranger simply the promise of cool abilities down the road, or do I get a ton of stuff off the bat?
You're mostly right. You get, at first level, you will have +1 against damage against humanoids.
Yep.
Right, and then that'll increase each level. You get 2d8 hit points instead of 1d10.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think you have the full tracking ability right off the bat.
Okay, so you get a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know. I always, of course, I just prefer a much lighter rule system. So, like, the fact that in order to support a huge number of different races and classes, you have to have every character has a huge number of special abilities that are unique to them. It just, the game becomes way too overburdened with mechanics for me.
I agree. From the DM's perspective, absolutely.
Right.
If you're a player and you only need to focus on one of these things, I can see that being palatable, but where the DM has to handle all of them, it's a real burden.
Yeah. Unfortunately, as a force in consumerism, the players outnumber us often 6 or maybe even 10 to 1.
So I hear, and then on the other hand, the counter argument is, without the DM, there isn't any game. So the making the DM happy is the spigot to make half a dozen players happy and part of the hobby.
It sounds like a very difficult thing to test and prove and bring as a PowerPoint to your product approval meeting.
True, and it's probably changing all the time.
Yep.
Right, and probably that's changing. As now things are on video, and we have live cast gaming, and that gets people intrigued in a different way. And probably, even if you could, in theory, nail that down one day, probably 6 months later, it's a different story.
In fact, if I get really cynical about it, there is a significant market, I think, to Wizards of the Coast of people who buy and read the books and don't play the game.
The first time I heard about that was 20 years ago, and I was like, what? Apparently that's...
It's a thing. It's a market. It exists. Yep.
What do you think the percentage is? Take a stab at what percentage of...
20. I'm going to say 20.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I think it's not all by choice, right? There's certainly some, uber collectors out there who just love it. I just love role-playing games. I'm just going to buy them all and collect them all and read them all. I do this myself with stupid board games. I have many board games on my shelf, you can see right behind me, that have not made it to the table yet. I've not played them.
Okay.
It's a bad addiction that I've actually stopped myself. On the other hand, you have... folks like David Heron, who's posting our comments right now, who just by circumstance, I still love this hobby, I still love to play, but I just, the opportunity's not there, but I want to buy and read the books, so I still feel like I'm participating and hope that someday I will get a game going.
That's pretty close to my heart. I can sympathize. I mean, I've been fortunate to have players, actually, but I could very easily imagine being in that situation. I'm really close to having been in that situation. So apparently 100% of our current viewer sample says that they've done exactly that. So
yeah. I mean, I suspect that the vast majority of people who fit that category are in the not by choice part of it, right? The sort of reading the books is better than nothing.
I bet there's at least some people that are like using it for like kernels of ideas or analysis or things like that. Maybe to feed in, I'm going to read this and then maybe feed it into my Warhammer game or something like that.
Yeah, that is totally true too. You're absolutely right. People are reading books of systems they don't intend to play just to steal ideas. For sure.
Right.
I'm sure that exists.
See, whereas on my end, like, I'm still trying to understand original D&D. I'm still furiously attempting to really understand the 0th edition of the game before I move on to any other game.
Yeah.
So I have no games behind me. but I can see from the corporate end, I totally understand what a real dilemma this is of selling more product. If you go back to like Gygax in 85, right? Unearthed Arcana came out for AD&D, and a lot of people really point angrily at that for really breaking AD&D because of these really overpowered barbarian class, cavalier class, and maybe this acrobat class possibly. And clearly that was intentional, and clearly they came out with this over the top, you're the uber player now if you just buy this book. And Gygax would argue that he had to do that in order to save the company because they were losing money in 84, 85.
Right.
So I can see a real corporate dilemma of selling more stuff to a point where it becomes burdensome to actually play.
And I'm sure, at some point, I'm sure some clever marketing person quipped, oh, if we target the players, we increase our market by 6 times. Like, I'm sure that sounded really smart the first time it came out. Oh, you're right. Splat books for everyone.
The first time I ever heard that was like around 2000, and it's, yeah, that's now that that's explicitly on the table, that's a real tough nut to crack.
Yeah. Now, I think, I do think that D&D Beyond solved this, right? So now I can buy my books digitally, and they cost the same amount on D&D Beyond as they do off the shelf, same price. I buy my books digitally, I create a campaign on D&D Beyond, I invite my players to it, and then I, as DM, pay a monthly fee for the privilege of sharing my books with my player base.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe I make my players pay for pizza or something, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's a pretty clever way of doing it. You know, it lets the DM still be the gatekeeper of the content, but I think they need some more tools in there to let me really be like, all right, well, if you're making a character in my campaign, here are my rules. You no tieflings in my campaign. Turn them off. Something.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be clever. I would think that would be. I think that would be clever.
Yeah. I should send that. I'm not gonna.
I wonder how
much
many
too
DMs
lazy
would
to write
do
that email. Was that
like how many DMs would do that? Like, I wonder how many DMs would bother to do that versus how many just throw up their hands and go, I don't, you know, I'm making it up on the fly anyway. The whole game, the whole campaign is all made up on the fly. I didn't even think about that in advance. Just do whatever's in the book.
Yeah, a lot, I think. You're not doing that until you're like 5 campaigns in and you're going, I don't like this stuff. Get it out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that might even be a smaller segment that you'd be trying to scratch.
Yep.
But for you and me, I would want that there. I want to be able to dictate what's in my campaign.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So I think that's about what I have on subclasses. I don't like them.
The thing is, for me, there's the problem is there's a fair amount of nostalgia to some concepts like a paladin or a ranger. Specifically, right. I'm going to call out those two subclasses. I don't have the same feeling about illusionists or assassins or cavaliers or thief acrobats or any, even barbarians. Even barbarians don't scratch that itch for me. Specifically, rangers and paladins do. Why is that? I'm going to blame the first edition player's handbook.
I will say that at the moment on the OD&D discussion forum, they're currently wrangling around barbarians. They're currently like, I want a barbarian class. I'm not happy with the ones with the 18 versions I've seen in the past. We're going to come up with the best possible original D&D barbarian class. So it's close. That might be like second tier. But I agree with you. For some reason, Paladin Ranger, I also agree, really stick in my head. And then, you know, Berserker Barbarian is a close follow-up, and I totally agree. The other ones don't stick.
But not like Illusionist or Druid for you. Which is
not for me.
Which is weird, right? And I have the same reaction, but those two are clearly in the first edition players, AD&D Players Handbook, whereas Barbarian's not.
I will say, I do think there's a segment of players that love the Druid. I think there's a segment of players that really love...
Oh, for sure.
You know, I'm a fantasy environmentalist, activist slash terrorist.
You're right. No, sure they have their fans.
Yeah.
I feel like we're encroaching on Mike Mercer's gnome effect problem of how, like a lot of people hate gnomes and think they're stupid, but that, like, if you poll 7 D&D players, one of them loves gnomes. Guess how many people sit around the table when they play D&D? 7. Therefore... Every D&D party loves gnomes, ergo. Every D&D game must include gnomes.
I am tickled by that argument.
It's a weird argument, but it's, me too. It's stuck in my craw since he wrote it back in 2008 or so.
That's great.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So to be clear, you currently run games, as much as these things stick in our heads, you currently run games with just three classes.
Yep, three classes, okay. Four races, end of story.
Okay.
When I run OD&D. And when I run fifth, I'm running fifth, so whatever the book says.
Understood.
Although I actually did, I did crankily say, only in the books I own as physical books, so Player's Handbook only. I don't know about your Xanathar's Guide to Everything, whatever's in there. I don't know. I don't want that.
People love Xanathar's Guide.
They do. They really do. It's quite popular.
Actually, I'm not kidding about that. I am aware of that.
Yeah. Too much for me to wrap my brain around. Too much. I don't own the book. I haven't sat down and read through it. I haven't even sat down and read through the entire 5th edition Player's Handbook at this point.
So. Gotcha. On Stack Exchange role-playing games, like half the questions are about stuff from Xanathar's Guide. There's like, can I do this? And so every single answer has to be, well, Player's Handbook says no, but Xanathar's Guide says yes. So make sure you understand whether that's on the table or not.
Yep.
Yeah.
Interesting point from the comments about how paladins and rangers maybe stand out because they are slightly more powerful than your standard fighter, whereas druids and illusionists are slightly less powerful than your standard magic user and cleric.
I think that's a good point, and I think that feeds into my point about, like, barbarians even being a whole nother... Barbarians in Unearthed Arcana being a whole nother power inflation step. I totally agree that illusionists are not any stronger. Some people will point to Druid and say that if you really focus on their shape-changing ability, they're actually a whole different...
Yeah.
They actually are at this more powerful tier.
I mean... and one we haven't talked about at all is monks. Personally, my brain seizes every time I think of martial arts, 70s martial arts movies happening in my D&D game. On the other hand, I play with a player who loves them.
Trivia at the end of our podcast. So in original D&D, once you had fighters, magic users, clerics, and thieves, everything was a subclass of one of those things. Monks were a subclass of which one?
Monks were a subclass? I thought they were their own thing. Jeez.
In AD&D, yes, but not in original D&D. In original D&D, they were originally a subclass of which one of those four things?
I would say that they must be a thief subclass.
No.
Fighter?
No.
No?
No.
Am I getting close? Is it cleric?
Well, I mean, there's only four.
Can't be magic user. It must be cleric. Doesn't make sense, though. They don't cast spells.
John Miller got that a couple seconds before Paul did.
What?
So John is... John and
but
now
they don't
Paul
have spells.
They were subclasses. Yeah, but they're religious holy men, right? They both come out of monasteries.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, for subclasses of cleric.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Anyway, let's wrap it up here. Great. So, classes. Subclasses. Call them what you will. I don't think it was ever really truly important whether it was a subclass of another class or not. I think it really just comes down to, do you add more classes or not, right? Do you have the standard four? Do you add more classes?
True. By saying a subclass, you're pointing them at a particular attack saving throw table.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost just a shorthand way of inventing a new class without having to write all the pages, right? Going, this class is like this other class, but with these changes, rather than I'm going to write it all out.
You know, they all get like a new XP table, and they all get up, you know, it's, I agree, it's not saving much space.
Yeah. All right, so if you have thoughts on whether you do or don't like subclasses, or think that they belong in your D&D game for reasons, or have an angle that we haven't thought of here, we'd love to hear it. Please post in our comments. We would love to reply. Or possibly spin off a whole new conversation as you push us into new weird ranges of thought.
We don't currently use subclasses in our games. I do use some feats, but if maybe someone's got a really great argument that would throw us in the other direction on that, so we would like to hear that. If you can come up with some crazy-ass argument like that. So, You can follow Paul and myself, the Wandering DMs, on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all three of those services. We are now live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So do please come back in a week and join us for another thought-provoking discussion on Wandering DMs. And we'll talk to you next time.
See you then.